The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 84.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's live stream. Boy, oh boy, we've got a lot to talk about. Usually, I like to start these live streams with a lot of energy and get everyone excited for the day. But boy, just for some reason, that just doesn't seem appropriate right now. I think today I want to make it all about solutions. We all know what the problems are right now in the world and more specifically in the United States. So, but there are a lot of solutions. There's a lot of things that we can do to be proactive and take action so we can ensure that our future, or the future of our family, is much better. It's all about taking action, though. I sent out a tweet where I said, do something, it's a quote. It said, do something today that your future self will thank you for. So I really want to focus on that. A couple things before we dive into the super chats. So some housekeeping stuff. Want to remind everyone that in the next week or two, we're going to be rolling out Rebel Capitalist Pro. And this is a digital product that I've created with Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. And it's got, it has their research. We do live stream Q&As with Chris and Lynn regarding their research, probably 3 to 4 times per month. But we're also doing an online member community, a forum where we can really get into the nitty-gritty about not only investing, but how to protect yourself and your family and your financial future moving forward. I think in the past few weeks, we've discussed Chris Cole's Dragon portfolio, where a key component of that is going long volatility. But I think right now, especially, you should be thinking about volatility from the standpoint of your physical location and not just your portfolio. And we'll be able to dive into a lot of things like that. But if you guys want to be emailed directly when we roll out the product, go ahead and send an email to george@georgegammon.com. Currently, that is going to my digital marketing person. His name is Gene. He's fantastic. So he can make sure that when we do roll out the product, whether it's in a week or 2 weeks, we're actually beta testing the form today, that you guys will get an email notification of that. Another thing, starting this week, we're going to switch it up a little bit. The interviews are going to be Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and the whiteboard videos are going to be Tuesday and Thursday. I might actually do both tomorrow. I might do a whiteboard video and an interview. But for right now, just keep in mind this week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday interviews, Tuesday and Thursday whiteboard videos. All right, let's go ahead and dive right into the super chats. Emmanuel, thank you for the super chat. Are prices stable or falling as a result of COVID in Medellin? How do you manage the COP currency risk on your real estate portfolio? What percentage of portfolio do you have in real estate currently? All right, a few questions here. Number one, prices are falling. And let me put it to you this way, Emmanuel. I think that in certain cases, actually, now that I think this through, let me be as specific as I can. I'm not sure that prices are falling here yet, but I do know there are a lot more for sale signs, and I know there are more motivated sellers than I've ever seen before. So how that translates into price, I'm not sure, because there's so little debt in the market. I don't know if broad stroke prices are going to come down much, but I do know that you can get some smoking deals right now if you know what you're doing and if you know how to negotiate. But I've also seen this in other places. I've been looking at real estate. Dubai, Chris and I talked about that, and we'll definitely talk about that further in Rebel Capitalist Pro. Puerto Rico, I've been noticing that there, you know, when I'm on Zillow and you can see the price action on the specific property, I'm noticing a lot of price drops for $10,000, $20,000. I've even seen $50,000 and $60,000 price drops on $400,000 properties. So I think this is something you're going to see. Probably the only place I haven't really seen it is in the United States. And I think that's because obviously you got these stimulus packages and checks going out and mortgage forbearance, and you don't have that in other countries. Not that I've seen. How do I hedge out my currency risk is basically your question. Number one, gold. I've make sure I've got 10% of my portfolio in gold. Number two is I have a broad diversity of currencies within my portfolio and real estate. It's not just COP. So I wouldn't suggest anyone, even if you live here and even if your expenses are denominated in the Colombian peso, there's no way I'd have 100% of your assets here or 100% of your assets denominated in pesos. No way. No way. For me right now, I've got probably 50% of my portfolio and more than 50% of my cash flow coming in United States dollars. And then I've got some in COP, then you've got the gold, and then you've got a few other things in there that really, I've got some Euro assets, but they're not a big percentage of the portfolio. But the key is you've got diversity, right? Remember, and I haven't talked about it lately, but one of my key investment strategies or speculative strategies is to make sure you not only diversify your portfolio, but you diversify your political risk and you diversify your currency risk. And I'm sure we'll get into political risk here a little bit more in the live stream based on what's happening in the United States right now. What percentage of my portfolio do I have in real estate? I would say maybe 50%, something like that, Emmanuel, maybe 50, 60%. And that's going to be the portion of my portfolio that I have allocated to investments, or excuse me, it's a percentage of the portion of my portfolio that I have allocated to investments, which I define as something that pays me to own it. That said, remember that a lot of the real estate is, I don't even really consider it part of my investment portfolio because it's more of like a side hustle. Or like a little mini, like a small business for me. The flips that I do in Colombia, I don't really consider that a part of my portfolio because I'm just buying something cheap. I'm having my team go in and remodel it, and then we're just flipping it. It's not. I don't really consider that an investment or a speculation, or I don't really consider it part of that of my portfolio. Honestly, I consider it more of like a side business. So. Deborah, thank you for the super chat. In a video, you said the next several years, home prices will likely drop to 2012. Yeah, but keep in mind, Deborah, I said in nominal terms or in real terms. And I'm thinking it may, I definitely think we'll go to 2012 lows, or not really lows, but historic averages, if you look at a chart going back to 1900, but it could do it in real terms, just adjusted for inflation. So in nominal terms, prices might not even go down. You later said real estate is so inefficient, it may take several years to see price drops. Yeah, but see, again, you've got to, it goes back to, I'm talking about not just in nominal terms, but in real terms, it can go down. And I'm talking, so now you're conflating two things there with just individual transactions and the broad market. When I'm talking about real estate prices being in a bubble in the United States, I'm just talking about overall. There are pockets of opportunity, especially because the real estate market is so inefficient. And now, who knows, especially with what's going on with the virus, you could find very motivated sellers that just need liquidity. They need it fast for whatever reason. And you can take advantage of that. So that's why I like real estate. And also, too, by the way, the United States, if inefficiency is one of the things that we like the most about real estate, and it is, it should be. If you know what you're doing, inefficiency is going to benefit the person who knows what they're doing, and it's going to really hurt the person who doesn't know what they're doing. So if we assume that we know what we're doing here, and we like to pride ourselves on being on knowing the comps and being educated and whatnot, I want to point out that the United States is probably the most efficient real estate market I've ever seen. So once you get outside the US, they get even more inefficient, which means more opportunity for those people who know what they're doing. So again, just to reiterate here, I think number one, I want to encourage you to look at prices adjusted for inflation, not just in nominal terms. And I'd also like to encourage you to look at the broad market for sure, but then also realize that it's very inefficient and you can still find pockets of opportunity, and to pay attention. But I think right now in the real estate market, you should be patient. Just let the market come to you. Micro Business Media, thank you for the super chat. SM creates and destroys wealth. Wondering when the market crashes, where does the money go? Although manipulated, seems you aren't against stocks as long as they are cheap. SM creates and destroys wealth. So I'm not sure. SM. I know that should be obvious what that is, but I'm not sure. But the main point of your question here is, when the market crashes, where does the money go? Well, it can go into cash. It can go into, I mean, it can leave the country. It can go into foreign debt. I mean, I think your point right now is that if the market crashes, where is the money has to have a place for it to go. But see, now you're getting pretty technical, because the stock market can crash and it doesn't necessarily mean that there's like physical money that needs to find a place, right? This really requires a whiteboard video, but let's say you own a share of Apple. That's, I don't know what it is. Let's say it's $300. It's trading at $300. And let's just say there's no bid for whatever reason. And the price goes from 300 to 250 to 225 to 200. And there's just not a bid. So that doesn't mean that, and let's just say finally you get a bid at 200 and that price, that stock is sold. Well, that's $100 of money, call it, that's gone. It evaporates. That $100 didn't leave the stock. It wasn't sold at 300. So then that $100 went somewhere, if that makes sense. That $100 was just paper wealth and it's gone. So it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, if you calculate the total value of the stock market, it means that if the stock market goes down by 50%, 50% of the prior value in money actually has to find some place to go, right? It doesn't always work that way, depending on how, you know, fast the market's dropping, a lot of different variables that get extremely complex. But I think kind of that's where you're going with it. But I mean, I think it can go into cash. It can go into, bonds. Sounds crazy, but it could definitely go into gold and silver. That's for sure. And it can definitely go into commodities. I know one of the last videos I did, I can't remember if it was last week or the week prior, I did some homework and I found that, and I actually went back through, I can't remember if it was news articles or like articles from the Wall Street Journal, but it was fund managers and people like in the investment bank saying, and this was back in the 70s and in the 80s, when and it might've been the 2000s as well, but when the market crashes in stocks and equities, a lot of times people and pros think that's very bullish for commodities, because people want to take their money, to your point, and they want it in an asset that isn't financialized. So they've had their stock portfolio. They said, you know what? It's too manipulated by the Fed. There's all this money printing, quantitative easing. I just don't trust the system anymore. I want my money in something real. So I want to put my money in oil, as an example, or in agriculture, or in soybean, you know, however you would do that. But it's going long commodity. And I think, boy, if people are just getting out of the market to a certain extent, remember, when the market crashes originally or initially, usually that's bad for gold and silver because big funds need liquidity. So they've got to sell anything they've got. Usually gold and silver is the asset they have that's most liquid, always going to be a bid. But after that ends, usually kind of the second wave, if you see the market crash, and then when it does, when it finally bottoms, then you see gold and silver go up, usually. At least it did in 2008 to an extreme. So I think commodities is really where I would look. So it's where I'm personally looking. Yeah, and although they're manipulated, I'm not against stocks if they're cheap. And that said, I mean, I wouldn't be against buying the S&P, believe it or not, if it was under maybe 10 on the CAPE ratio. So if you took the average PE multiple of the S&P or the companies in the S&P, and if they're under 10, if you could buy it at like a 5 or a 7, sure, I'd buy the S&P all day long. But they're just not cheap right now. And I like uranium. I like uranium as a speculation. I think someone just tweeted me about uranium, and I own uranium. But to be clear, it's not in the investment bucket of my portfolio. It's in the speculative bucket, which I just allocate 10% to. The Cara Fawn, thank you for the super chat. So S number one, you are in Medellin. Don't you just love Colombia? I do love Colombia. I do. And I really especially enjoy Medellin because of the weather, the people, the food, the cost of living. It's just the growth potential. Remember when I interviewed Jim Rogers, and Jim said, and I didn't ask him to say this. In fact, we didn't even bring it up prior to him mentioning it. It was one of his favorite cities moving forward is Medellin. He's from an investment standpoint, he's extremely excited about Medellin. And you know Jim, he's a very long-term thinker. So when he says he's super excited about Medellin, he's not talking about the next 6 months, the next year or two. He's talking about the next 20 years. And I couldn't agree with him more. But that said, I'm the type of person, I don't like to get married to any one geographical location. I don't really, and in fact, also when people say, George, you live in Medellin, you'll notice I often kind of correct them that I don't really live in Medellin. I spend time here, but I don't really live in any one place. I live wherever I want to be at the time. And if I feel as though I'd prefer to be somewhere else right now, then I'm just going to hop on a flight and go. And so unfortunately, I can't do that right now because the whole darn country is in lockdown. And trust me, I have tried. Sebastian is on the live stream right now, and he knows the extent that I've gone to try to get out of the country and get to the Caribbean, to one of the smaller islands, to where I could, you know, just get out on the beach and enjoy myself a little bit more, not be trapped in an apartment. I went so far as to try to charter a plane. Just charter a jet out of the local airport here in Medellin to take me to Puerto Rico or anywhere else. We couldn't do that. I tried to charter a yacht and get to Cartagena and then have like one of those catamaran, those 50-foot catamarans. I tried to charter one of those to take me to one of the islands. If I've set my mind to something, as you guys have probably figured out by now, I don't mind getting out of the box, and I will go to every extreme to try to make it happen, regardless of how crazy the idea is. But my point is right now, I'm just still in Medellin, so I'm not really saying, hey guys, you know, come move to Medellin right now. I think just right now, if I could choose any place to be, or I'd advise any place for people going, would be the Caribbean. And just like Hugh Hendry and Raoul Paul in their conversation on Real Vision, where they're talking about going long volatility through their geographical location, I think that's a very, very smart thing to do with considering what's going on in the United States, which in my opinion will most likely get worse, unfortunately. Hopefully it'll subside over the next couple of days. But if you look at the next 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, I think it's just going to get worse, especially when you look at what the Fed's doing, and they'll most likely try to solve any additional problem through quantitative easing, money printing, which will exacerbate wealth inequality. And it's just, I don't see it being a good situation. So like I said on Twitter many times over the last 24 hours, I think you should look at volatility from a standpoint of your physical location and not just your portfolio. I think I said that at the top of the live stream. Oh, would I go on it? Okay, I didn't read your whole question here. would you go on a date with me in Medellin or anywhere? Boy, I hate to commit to that right now, Kara. I mean, I'm flattered. I appreciate it. It's very kind of you. I don't know if I can commit to that right now, especially on lockdown. Why don't you maybe, I don't know, maybe email Sebastian after lockdown or something. I'm not sure. Unfortunately, I'm not really thinking about my personal life right now. I'm just thinking about how I can get to a Caribbean island so I could just get out and get some exercise and get out of my apartment. My energy rocks. Thank you very much. I know my energy's kind of toned down a little bit today based on what's going on, but thank you. All right. I think hopefully that answered the majority of your question, Kara. John, thank you for the super chat. Is U.S. on the verge of economic social collapse? Well, I don't know if they're on the verge of social collapse. I think we're past the verge, my friend. I don't know what you would call this. I'm not in the U.S. All I know is what I see on the kind of going through the news and looking at my Twitter feed. I'm trying not to use U.S. news outlets just because they can be so biased and so on the right and left. So I'm just trying to watch like the BBC or trying to watch like an Australian or anything that I think will be a little more balanced, let's say, in their approach to the reporting, but mostly just on my Twitter feed from a lot of the financial guys and gals I follow, because I'm not sure where I was. I think I was on Burick's show the other day, Jason Burick with Wall Street for Main Street, but I was talking about how whenever I look at something that can have a political slant to it, I try to look at it, or I try to listen to money managers, just because usually, not always, but usually I think their view is going to be as unbiased as possible because they've got skin in the game. They've got money. The politicians don't have any money at stake. In fact, they make more money the more they lie. And the media, obviously, it behooves them to take one side or the other. And even for the general population, you know, we've got this tribalism, unfortunately, we as human beings. And so we take a stance. But if you're managing $20 billion of other people's money, regardless of your political views, you really don't have the luxury of having a political bias and expressing that through your investment philosophy. If you do, you're probably not going to last too long. So that's why I kind of like to watch the macro voices or listen to the macro voices and the Real Vision for my content around these types of subjects that can be very polarized, I think is the best way I can say it. But yeah, I mean, listen, the United States economically, it has been built on a house of sand. We have built an entire economy on very artificially low interest rates, the Fed expanding their balance sheet. We've built an entire economy around asset prices and debt. Think about this. Is it any shock that what's happening in the United States right now is actually happening when you look at how we've, I'm not going to say grown the economy, but how we've made the economy evolve. And when I'm talking about I'm talking about the Fed and the government. They have produced this Frankenstein type of economy that is built on asset prices and debt. So if you are a part of the American society that doesn't have access to debt, or you don't own assets, you're screwed. You're screwed because it's the only, and I'm not going to say it's the only way to get ahead. We can work hard and, you know, we can put our nose to the grindstone, and I'm all about self-reliance. But because the Fed has created inflation since 1913, 2,000% inflation since 1913. If you really think through what inflation does to an economy, it forces people to go into assets, to keep pace. So if we had no inflation, or if we actually had price deflation, like you'd have in a healthy economy, the opposite would be true. People would be incentivized to save money and to save for a rainy day and to build wealth and be able to take the wealth that they've built and passed it from generation to generation in the form of their savings account, not in some sort of financial derivative that is traded back and forth 45,000 times a day in the repo market or something like that. I mean, is it any wonder we're seeing what is going on right now in the United States? When you look at how we've built the economy, it's just, hello. I mean, wasn't it obvious? And isn't it obvious that when the Fed tries to double down on these policies, that it'll only get worse? The Fed's balance sheet is at $7 trillion. You think they're going to back that out? You think they're going to somehow unwind their balance sheet now? I mean, are you kidding me? And what happens if we get a second wave of the Cerveza sickness where everyone, I mean, this is something that nobody's really thinking through. So yes, the government, let's say they've eased the lockdown policies so people can go back to work, businesses can start to open up, and I'm talking about the United States. Well, okay, that's fine. And Trump has come out and said, we're no matter what happens with the Cerveza sickness, we will not go into lockdown again. Fine. He's talking about the government. Okay. What if we have another massive wave that comes through and people put themselves into lockdown? So the government might not have to put us in lockdown. We might do it ourselves. And not that I like that, not that I'm against that, not that I'm for that. I'm just trying to think through like a fund manager would without having any sort of bias and saying this could really happen to where if we have a second wave, people lock themselves in, right? And then what do you do? The government said you're free to go to work, but no one wants to go to work, or no one wants to open the cafe, or no one wants to open the small business, right? Then what happens to the supply destruction? Then what happens to the supply chains? What happens to the price of food? And then what's the Fed's response going to be, or the government? It's going to be more of the same. And also, do you really think that with what's going on with the unemployment benefits, that in an election year, that's going to be taken away, or the Fed is going to try to normalize interest rates in an election year? Absolutely not. So we're not, I know I'm going off on a tangent here, but it's very important that people realize that this American economy we have has been built or created around a subsidy of cheap interest rates and cheap money. So you can't just take that away, or else the whole entire house of cards comes crashing down. So, but we're not even staying at a consistent level, right? What we're doing is we're adding to the balance sheet. We're adding to the money printing. We're keeping interest rates lower longer. We might go negative, right? So if you think about a country like Ecuador or Venezuela, who subsidize the price of fuel. So let's just say their cost of gas is like 20 cents a gallon when it should be $3 a gallon. Think about doing that for 20 years, how massively that would distort the economy. What the United States is doing right now is they're not just keeping the cost of fuel at 20 cents a gallon, they're lowering it, right? They're taking it down to 15 cents, to 10 cents, to 5 cents. They're making fuel zero. And I'm just using that as an analogy, of course. And so if the economy has been distorted through the Fed keeping interest rates at zero for 8 years and then artificially low for a lot longer and taking their balance sheet to $4 trillion, how distorted is the economy going to be when the Fed takes their balance sheet to $10 trillion, to $15 trillion and takes rates negative if they do? You got to start thinking about this stuff and you got to start taking action now. So if, and I hope it doesn't, but if it does get worse, you're positioned, you're okay. You've got a plan B and you're not in the thick of things where you wake up one morning, you look out the window and there's riots and fires and guns going off and explosions and You've got to take precautionary measures before that happens. You can't just wait and say, "Oh well, when I see the people out in the streets with the pitchforks, destroying every single bank and building, then I'll go ahead and I'll take action or I'll take measures to get myself out of Dodge." It's too late then, or it could be. This podcast is sponsored by my friends at Capitalist Exploits, one of the few research letters I read myself. If you want more information on how this powerful tool can help you become a better investor, plus get a 15% discount, check out our affiliate link. We'll put it right in the show notes page. Jay Kerr, thank you for the super chat. Any social conscious company expert strategies you recommend? Green energy? No, it's not that I'm opposed to that, Jay. It's just that usually those types of companies don't make money, or at least they don't have cash flow. And I really don't like investing in companies that don't throw off a profit right now. I really hesitate with that personally. I'm not saying that philosophically it's not good, it's good or bad or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. I'm trying to think. Yes, he's socially conscious. I know you're not going to like this answer, but maybe uranium. And I know you don't like that answer, Jay, but I think that from what I've read, and I'm not an expert, but uranium could be the best of the, or it could be the greenest non-green energy. I'm trying to phrase this the right way. I think you understand what I'm saying though. I know it's got its downsides. I get it. But I think if people are looking for a form of energy that's the most green, say that, but still has a lot of density, has just as much, maybe more, I don't know the exact numbers, but it's right around oil instead of having to go backwards quite a bit. Because once you get into wind, solar, if you saw my interview with Art Berman, it gets really tough, especially with the technology the way it is today. Because there's a lot, the energy source is a lot less dense. Oh, copper. There you go. Copper. I like copper because it's cheap. It's a commodity. Therefore, I think it could be an inflation hedge. I haven't looked at it lately, so I don't know what the price has done in the last month or so. But I know it was really cheap, and I know that's a really big component battery operated car, like Teslas and the hybrid cars and electric cars and electric vehicles. So that's probably what I'd do. I'd look at maybe uranium. If you just can't stand that at all, I'd look at copper. Okay, next question. Atlas, thank you for the super chat. 3 cap in Burj Khalifa, thoughts? Oh, wait for it to get lower. I've been looking at the Burj Khalifa myself, and I think you're going to be able to get a lot better than a 3 cap. I like the Burj Khalifa because it is just a landmark building, and if you can buy something in there as cheap as you can buy it now, I think that's great. But I think it's another thing like the U.S. that I don't know if now's the time to go buy it. Be cognizant of it. And that was my point with Chris, and that's what I'm doing for myself, but I'm not jumping out there right now. I get it. The market has crashed. I understand that you can get some super cheap deals. Not only that, there's very little price discovery in the market right now. So the prices you see online, if that's where you've been looking, Atlas, I don't think those are real prices. Those were the prices like prior to what's going on. You just don't have a bit. You don't have any buyers or sellers right now, which would be my guess. Or you have a lot fewer. So you really aren't getting good price discovery there. I think that once we get COVID in the rearview mirror or before the next wave or however you look at it, when they start to open back up and you see some transactions, then you might see prices drop substantially. Also, I don't know if Chris got into it, and this is one thing we'll dive into really deep with Rebel Capitalist Pro, obviously, is they could lose their peg. And I don't know if you guys saw my video I did on HSBC Hong Kong Kyle Bass, where I talked about the Hong Kong peg and how that works and why that is. If a country like Hong Kong, or if a city, I guess you want to call it, like Hong Kong or a place like Dubai, if they lose their peg, it takes them straight into the no bueno zone, to say the least. And so if that peg goes, boom, and if you're buying in dollars, not only could real estate go down even further in Durham, which I think is their currency, but it could just plummet when you look at it in dollar terms. Right. So let's just say, I think the peg is 3.7. Let's say the peg goes to 5 overnight, boom, like that. Or they lose the peg and it goes to the exchange rate instead of 3.7 to 1 goes to 5 to 1 or 6 to 1. Boy, your purchasing power just goes through the roof. So I don't really like anything at a 3% cap rate. But I do like the Burj Khalifa. But it's on my watch list. It's not on my buy right now list. I think that's the best way I can say it. Andres, thank you for the super chat. George, would you consider gaining interest on Crypt? 4% to 8% of part of an investment portfolio. Please discuss this with Simon Black. Yeah. I mean, if you could get 8%, well, I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know, Andres, because I like it that it pays you to own it, but what's the intrinsic value there? And it can go to zero. And I really, that's why I like real estate so much. It's hard for it to go to zero. I don't know. That's a really good question. I still might consider that a speculation. Although a better speculation, because you're getting paid. I would have to think that through, but I definitely wouldn't immediately put that into the bucket of investments just because it's paying me to own it with all, you know, the super cheap dividend paying stocks and real estate that's you're bringing in rent and hopefully getting a 10 or 12% cash on cash return every year. But I'll definitely bring it up with Simon for sure. Zoomer, thank you for the super chat. You've done a number of videos on negative rates and stagflation, but Jerome Powell has categorically said there won't be any negative rate. I assume you're joking, but just to finish your question, Jerome Powell has categorically said There won't be any negative rates, and they do not expect inflation. I would take that as a contrarian indicator. Anything the Fed says, I would take as a contrarian indicator. At the very least, I would look at it through their lens. And what I mean by that, I think the Fed knows very well the economy is built on asset bubbles, debt, and confidence. So whenever they come out and make a statement, they have to make sure that it isn't doing too much to damage in confidence, right? If you've got like a scale between telling the truth and instilling confidence, confidence is always going to win that battle with the Fed, always, because they're very Keynesian. So they see this as a demand side equation, that they've got to increase demand. And there's no way that demand will increase if confidence is going down, right? So, or most likely. So they see that confidence is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, that if the consumer loses confidence, there will be less spending, less demand, and then the economy goes down, and then it's this downward kind of doom vortex type situation. That's how they're seeing it. So I would just pretty much either ignore what they're saying or look at it through that lens. Now, I would also remind you that Jerome Powell said when he first was the Fed chair that they are not in the business of this, of a Fed put, or they're not in the business of maintaining a certain level in the stock market. He also said that when they went into the repo market, that was just a temporary glitch. He also said that he was going to reverse the balance sheet of the Fed and it wouldn't be a big deal. I think his predecessor went so far, Yellen went so far as to say it would be like watching paint dry. I don't know if that was Powell or Yellen, but one of them said that. So listen, they have been wrong so many times. And they've lied to us. So now you might say that their let's just call them a lie, is justified, because if they didn't lie, it would be a lot worse for the entire economy. I understand that argument. But the bottom line is they've lied. They do it all the time, just like politicians. They're just going to tell you what they think you need to hear. And they do that so often, I don't think we should pay any attention to what they say. But if you do pay attention to what they say, again, I would suggest doing it through the lens of how they see the economy. Cody, thank you for the super chat. Good to see you, Cody. I know you've been on the chats and in the comments for a long, long time. So I appreciate it, buddy. I really do. Have you seen many lenders starting to tighten up their refinance operation in regard to qualified borrowers? I don't have a good read on that, Cody, because I just deal with one bank in Kansas City as far as just the leverage I use on my properties there. And it's not a good read on the overall market because I have an incredibly tight relationship with the bank. I've been doing business with them since maybe 2014 or so. And I know the head of commercial lending there, the VP of commercial lending, I know him really well. Whenever I'm in Kansas City, we're always going to dinner, we go to lunch, we get caught up. A lot of my buddies in Kansas City, they play basketball with them, and they're all part of the same group going out and grabbing beers and stuff. So there's a very strong trust relationship. And this gentleman and the bank, they trust me because every deal I've done with them, knock on wood, we've made money, and I've never made a late payment to them. They just auto debit my account. They know there's plenty of money in there. I'm like the perfect customer, except I do call and complain every once in a while about their online platform is garbage. But other than that, I think I'm a perfect customer. So I don't think that's the same type of experience you would have just walking into a random Wells Fargo or Bank of America, something like that. So I do think they will most likely tighten their lending standards. Especially, you got to look at it from the bank standpoint, that they can issue all these loans through the, the Main Street, I forgot the acronym now or the abbreviation, but it's the Fed's Main Street Lending Program. And if you look at the fine print there, yes, it goes through the banks, but the banks are offloading 95% of the risk to the Fed. They're only keeping 5% of the loan or the risk on their balance sheet, according to what I read. So if you're a bank, would you rather move as many loans as you possibly can where the Fed is backstopping 95% of it? Or would you rather go even to a qualified buyer where you might have to backstop everything? Although most likely you'd probably sell it to Fannie and Freddie. But let's just say that it's a commercial loan and the bank is holding it on their books. I'd rather do something that the Fed is backstopping. So it's just the irony, and it's what Jeff Snyder always talks about, that the Fed has control over the base money. They have control over printing bank reserves, but they actually have very little control over creating additional M2 money supply. That really is in currently, and this could change, and I think it probably will change, but currently that is on the shoulders of the retail and the commercial banking sector. They have to create loans. They have to create money supply by issuing more and more loans. And if they're not issuing more and more loans, and relative to the pace that people are paying back the principal, that's actually M2 destruction. M2 is going down. So if you have money supply going down, not that it is now, I know now it's just going parabolic, but I'm just giving you a situation where it could go down. And in that case, you may have less money supply chasing less or the same amount of goods and services. But I know Schiff would argue that even if you do have less money supply, you would have the rate or the amount of goods and services decreasing at a faster pace if that played out. And therefore, you would still see consumer price inflation. And I would tend to agree to a certain level. But I think the Fed and the government is going to figure out, they're going to figure out a way to get to continue to increase M2 and have more control over M2. Maybe it's just simply by the government spending more and more money, raising or increasing deficits, and then just having the Fed monetize the debt, which is just a fancy way of saying that the government issues the treasury and the Fed buys it within seconds through the primary dealers. You know, it's just such a con game, isn't it? And if you guys don't know how this works, the treasury will issue the treasury's long-term T-bills, whatever, and the primary dealer banks will come in and buy them. They'll be at the auction. You know, I bid this, or however those auctions work. The primary dealer banks will buy them. And then literally seconds later, they'll just flip them right to the Fed, and the Fed will buy them from the primary dealer banks. And it's just a shell game to make it seem like we're not a banana republic, the United States, and we're not just buying directly, like the central bank isn't buying directly from the federal government. But it's just it's a con game. So I think I've answered that question well. Thank you again, Cody, for supporting the channel for so long. All right, next question. Free Thinker, another person that I think I've recognized from the channel for a long time. How has the unrest changed your view on best U.S. market for real estate, important demographic? Yeah, great question, buddy. That's a good question. It's definitely made me more patient. And it's definitely made me take pause. That's for sure. So prior to what we've seen this weekend, prior to that happening, I was in the camp of, okay, linear market's good. Rental property's good for sure. We want cash flow. We want cheap cash flow. It's cheap debt. Now's probably not the time to buy. You want to let the market come to you. If the market's going to settle, if it's going to go down, but you should be out there kicking tires in case you can find a smoking deal or a super motivated seller. I mean, I'd still be in that mindset, Free Thinker, but I would be hyper focused on the neighborhood. And as let's use Kansas City as an example. There are three places that I like to invest in Kansas City. One is an area, a little suburb called Independence. Another is a little suburb called Blue Springs. And another is a suburb called Lee's Summit. Lee's Summit is the best suburb on the Missouri side of Kansas City, in my opinion. So it's definitely the most affluent. So if I was looking at properties right now and just looking at deals, I would only look, and again, I would be patient. I would let the market come to me, but I would only be considering Lee's Summit right now. There's no way I'd consider, probably not even Blue Springs, because like Independence is kind of they're all good markets. Don't get me wrong. They're all good neighborhoods, but Independence, it's kind of a little borderline, and Blue Springs is kind of a notch up, but I would only consider just the best neighborhoods where there's not many rental properties and people are going to be a lot less likely to go down and burn their neighborhood because they own the neighborhood. They own the real estate. No one's going to go burn down their own house. Well, maybe they will, but most likely they're not going to burn down their own house if they own the house. But if it's some rental property, who knows? Maybe they just torch it just to prove a point, or I don't know. It's tough to get into the mental state of people who are extremely frustrated. But that's kind of how I'd do it. I'd have my same stance, my same framework, patience, let the market come to me. But even if the market did come to me, I would only consider just top tier neighborhoods where the majority of the people living in the neighborhood owned real estate in the neighborhood. Okay, next question. Andrew, thank you for the super chat. Are you concerned about safety in PR from economic turmoil? Not as much. There's several reasons for that, Andrew. I'm trying to be as honest and as straightforward as I can, Andrew, but I'm also trying to be sensitive to the current situation. That's why I'm pausing. I don't see it as much of a concern because I don't. Well, let me start with the easy way to answer this question, because I'm trying to tackle the hard one first. The easy way to answer this question is you've got a lot of marinas in Puerto Rico, and you have a lot of these little Caribbean airlines. And I've been doing a lot of homework on this over the last few days, if you guys could probably tell. And they have all these little kind of puddle jumper airlines where they have 8 or 10 of these. And I forgot the names. I should have pulled them up on my computer, but it's not like Caribbean Airlines, but it's like Island Air or Intra Island Airlines or something like that. There's like 5 or 6 of them. And these little they got the puddle jumpers with the twin engine planes, and they kind of hop from Puerto Rico to maybe the British Virgin Islands. You can go from the British Virgin Islands down to St. Kitts or St. Barts or over to the Cayman or the Dominican Republic, something like that. It's not like American Airlines or JetBlue, or it's just these little teeny weeny planes that maybe seat 10 people or something. But you've got a few of those, and I've noticed a lot of them are still running right now for the islands that have opened back up or will be opening back up soon. So the way I look at Puerto Rico, number one, is from a tax standpoint. As for Act 2022, they've changed it to, I believe it's called Act 60 now. But that's a great way, in fact, the only way for an American to get out of the U.S. tax system legally. So obviously, that's what I suggest. I would only ever suggest you doing something that was totally, completely legal. So if you can get to Puerto Rico and really get a great break on your taxes, not only from your a business, even a small business, but from capital gains tax, if you do own stocks or bonds or anything like that, Bitcoin, gold, I believe it's for Bitcoin and gold. But you also have this, you're kind of in an area where your mobility is much greater than it would be if you were in Kansas City, as an example, or Medellin, Colombia, something like that. And then if you combine that with having a second passport, and that's something that I've talked about occasionally, I've really been talking about it over the past couple of days. I'll probably talk about it even more on next week's videos, on the whiteboard videos. But a lot of countries I've read now aren't allowing Americans into the country. And as Americans, we don't even think about that because we're so accustomed to just going wherever we want, whenever we want in the entire world. Why on earth would that little ho-dunk country not want my dollars? Why would they not want my tourism business? Of course, well, I'm American. Of course they want me to come to their country. I can go anywhere I want. I'm an American. Maybe not so much right now. Whether you dispute the numbers or not, the mainstream numbers are saying that the biggest caseload for the virus is, or the most cases are in the United States. And again, I'm not saying that's right, wrong. I'm not saying the numbers are accurate or not accurate or anything like that. I don't want to get caught up in that nonsense. But I am saying that if you just look at the frontline numbers they're using in the media, the U.S. has the most cases. So a lot of these countries, and I think I was reading specifically about Dubai, where they were opening back up to tourists, except American tourists. And you may say, oh, I don't care. I don't want to go to Dubai anyway. Yeah, but if it's Dubai today, it might be somewhere else tomorrow. And if we get a second wave, and who knows where it's going to be. So my point is, if you're in Puerto Rico and you got a couple passports, let's say you've got a U.S. passport and one for St. Kitts or Grenada or Malta or Montenegro, Croatia, one of these places, then all you do is just hop on the plane and you just use your other passport. And all of a sudden, you're not an American anymore. You're a Montenegrin, if that's the right word. So you see, and now all of a sudden you can go to St. Bart's, you can go to Antigua or any of these places that might not allow Americans to come in, but they'll allow people from other small parts that might not be having as much of an issue with the virus, or who knows what it's going to be in the future, right? It just gives you that flexibility that you don't have if you just are kind of tied to one passport. And, you know, I started thinking this way back in probably 2010, even before I retired, even before I got into macro, by listening and reading a guy named Simon Black. And he has a fantastic website called sovereignman.com. And if you haven't read Sovereign Man, definitely go check it out. I can't recommend it enough. If any of you know Simon, tell him I'd love to interview him for the Rebel Capitalist show. I know he's in Puerto Rico, so maybe I'll get the opportunity. I think he's out at Dorado with Schiff. So who knows? Maybe I'll get the chance to meet him and, or maybe play golf with him or something like that. And I can convince him to come on to the Rebel Capitalist show. But my point is, what he always says is, what's your downside? Like, if you get a second passport, what's your downside? There is none. There is absolutely no downside. So, and I understand people have families and they can't just jump around like I do, but I think it's definitely something to consider. Even if you do have a family, though, a lot of the Caribbean islands have passport programs for the entire family, like up to a family of six. I was just reading the other day. So if you've got, and by the way, guys, I'll probably mention this in my videos, but just so you know, because of the virus and the financial difficulties a lot of the islands are having, like St. Kitts, like Dominica, I believe is the, but Antigua, there's a lot of these islands out there, and they are offering huge discounts on their passports or their investment citizenship because they need money. They're really hurting because of the lack of tourism. So they've dropped the prices. And I mean, as an example, St. Kitts used to be, I think, 400 grand. You had to invest in real estate there. Now they dropped it to like 250. And I know for some people that's still, it is definitely a lot of money. But my point is that the prices are going down. You can get some smoking deals on passports right now. And then in some areas, they're a lot cheaper, you know, 100 grand. But you can invest in real estate there for as little there. I mean, I'm talking about all the islands, because there's different programs for different places, right? But you can invest in a place like Antigua for like 230 grand and buy like in a little apartment there, a nice place to kind of have a bug out area. And they give you the passport and you can travel visa free. It's like 129 countries with that Antigua passport, right? You can go to many countries in the Eurozone. You can go to a lot of South American countries. You can go to a lot of nice developed countries that anyone would love to travel to just as a tourist. So that's, I know I've really gone off on a tangent now that I look at your question, but that's the main reason I'm not as concerned about safety. Now, as far as just the riding, I just don't see that happening in Puerto Rico. It's just a different culture. It's a different culture. They have a different history. I just don't see it. I don't see them burning down their own city. Maybe I'm wrong. I just don't see that. But even if they did, again, I think being there, you've got a lot more mobility and freedom and flexibility than you would have in Medellin, Colombia, Kansas City, Minneapolis, Ohio, any place like that. Okay, next question. Breath of Water. Thank you for the super chat. Hey, George, have you thought about whether thorium could replace uranium in the future as a fuel source of nuclear energy? I've gone back and forth with Chris, and I haven't talked to Eric specifically about it, although maybe I did. I think one of those interviews I did with Eric way back when the Cerveza sickness was coming out, I think we might have touched on that. But I don't really have a good enough read on that. I'm very comfortable right now having part of my speculative portfolio in uranium. I'm not saying that thorium might, I don't know how you'd buy it. I don't know if you can go long. I'm not sure how that would work, but assuming that you can go long, maybe it's a great speculation. But I definitely wouldn't buy it with the majority of my portfolio. Just a very, very small portion. Okay, next question. Andres, thank you for the super chat. Can you give us an example of your investment portion portfolio? I'm now invested, so I'm not sure what to classify as investment stocks, real estate yield. Yeah, so with me, it's just dividend paying stocks and real estate, really, in that side of my portfolio. That I don't know what else you could throw in there. Maybe if you could get paid somehow. Yeah, it gets kind of technical, though. I was talking to Rick Rule about being able to lend out your gold and getting paid. I don't know. See, that's a little too fancy for me. I like to keep things simple. But for me, it's just pretty much if I can get cheap dividend paying stocks or real estate, maybe bonds. It depends. I know I was talking to Jim Rogers about ruble bonds, and he won't admit it, but I know he made a killing on those on the ruble bonds he bought back in I forgot when he bought them, like 2015-16. And if you guys watched my interview with Jim, I know he doesn't give tips or anything, and I don't blame him, but he did say that ruble bonds today, and this was a couple weeks ago, could be interesting just because the ruble's cheap. I know he's really bullish Russia long-term, maybe not short term, but long term, you know, the next 10, 20 years. I mean, if you could get a, I don't know what the yield is now, but if you could get a 10, 12, 15% yield on a Russian, on a ruble bond, that could be interesting. But I kind of like the equities a little bit better than the bonds, because I'm kind of worried about inflation with fiat currency and all fiat currencies, not just the dollar. And if you've got bonds, you're buying the currency of that country. And I don't really, I'm a little hesitant there, but that would be another obvious third option. This podcast is sponsored by my friends at Capitalist Exploits, one of the few research letters I read myself. If you want more information on how this powerful tool can help you become a better investor, plus get a 15% discount, check out our affiliate link. We'll put it right in the show notes page. TP, thank you for the super chat. What should Canadian investors do? Why don't have 30-year fixed rate mortgage? Oh, we don't have 30-year fixed rate mortgage. Yeah. Longest fixed rate is 5 to 10 years. Can we hedge rising rates? I would look at the United States, well, probably not now, but I mean, if you would have asked me this question, especially like 3 months ago, I would have said, look at the United States. And maybe if you asked me the same question 3 months from now, I would say the same thing. I know it's very easy for Canadians to invest in the U.S. and even get loans, 30-year fixed rate loans. So actually, you know what? Let me take that back. I know it's very easy for Canadians to invest. I know it's easy for them to get loans. I don't know if it's easy for them to get the 30-year fixed rate product that you would have to get through Fannie and Freddie, is basically what's happening there. The bank is selling it to Fannie and Freddie, and Fannie and Freddie is subsidizing that, because the bank would never keep a 30-year fixed rate loan on their books. So that's a better question for Hartman, Jason Hartman. So maybe you might want to go to jasonhartman.com and see if he's got any information there on his website, how that would work. I know he works with a lot of Canadians, a lot of foreigners in general. Also, I remember, and I didn't speak to Hugh specifically on this, Hugh Hendry, but I remember in his interview with Raoul Paul, Hugh was able to buy his property in St. Bart's with fixed rate debt, euro denominated. I know he was saying that he got a loan from a French bank at like 2%, denominated in euros, that was fixed for 20 years. So that, I don't know how that would work with Canadians, but that could be an option. I mean, Hugh's Scottish, so it's he's not French. So if he's able to get literally millions of dollars from a French bank denominated in euros at a 20-year fix to invest in St. Bart's, and maybe that's another advantage of some of those little islands. You know, a lot of those little islands are, I don't know if they're owned or managed, I don't know what the right word is, but they're run by a bigger country like the United States, or they're affiliated with France, or maybe I don't know, Denmark, maybe. I'm not sure. I'd have to do more homework. But so then if you're, let's say St. Bart's is a territory of France, and the French banks are willing to lend, as a result of that, the French banks are willing to lend on that, you might be able to get some fixed rate debt that way, maybe outside the United States or outside of Canada. Really, the bottom line is you've got to get creative. That we're not in a, this isn't the 1980s. Or the 1960s, or even the 70s or 90s, where there was just, oh my gosh, well, I mean, all you have to do is just buy a 10-year treasury and you get 7%. What's not to like? I mean, those days are, unfortunately, they are over. And investing and speculating is getting harder and harder and harder and harder. That doesn't mean that there's not opportunities. And it's not to say the opportunities might not be even better, but you're going to have to get a lot more creative, and you're going to have to do more and more and more homework. And I'll use that to, as a shameless plug for Rebel Capitalist Pro. That's exactly what we're going to be doing there. We're going to be just taking deep dives. I know Chris is all about it. Lynn is all about it. We're going to be going into the, I think the forum, the community is going to be really all about finding these pockets of opportunity that are hard to find. You can't just blindfold throw a dart anymore and get a 10% return. But if you look, they're out there. And there's ways to take advantage of things that may be more esoteric or just it's going to be like finding a needle in a haystack, but it doesn't mean the needle's not there. And again, that's what we're really going to be focused on with Rebel Capitalist Pro. David, thank you for the super chat. Could you do a whiteboard video on COMEX gold futures and why banks have lost millions and why they are leaving COMEX? Yeah, I need to do some more gold videos, David, and I'm not sure if they'll be this week or maybe the week after, but obviously there's a lot going on with gold that I want to talk about. Not only, obviously, I'm very bullish on gold, but there's some tax, capital gains tax on gold. That whole it's a very gray area. I don't really know that the retail person that's really excited about gold really understands the from a capital gains standpoint, how that works with gold bars, gold coins, et cetera, and how that can work with inflation, assuming that gold, maybe it goes up with inflation, maybe it goes up in real terms, but I think that's one component that a lot of gold investors aren't really thinking through, and they need to. And my point is there's a lot of stuff regarding gold, silver, and Bitcoin that I really want to talk about. And I know I'll be doing it on my interviews, and hopefully I can get to it with the whiteboard videos over the next couple weeks. Okay, next question. Free Thinker, thank you for another super chat. Fourth Turning plus Dalio. Yeah. Yep, Neil Howe, Fourth Turning, great book. Dalio Debt Cycle, Long Term, Short Term. And then The Hawk Deleveraging from Chris Cole and the Allegory of the Hawk and Serpent. All great points. I think you're definitely doing the right research, my friend. As far as the end game, I think you're asking me, I would say that it's a combination of all of those. I think that's kind of your point. You're not asking me which is it. I think you're saying it's probably a combination of both or of all of these put together. And I do. I think we're going to have a deleveraging. Now, whether it's inflationary or deflationary, who knows? If I had to place a bet right now, I'd probably say stagflationary. But it's not that I'm 90% confident. I totally get the deflationist argument, and I respect that. As far as Fourth Turning, I mean, I think that's what we're seeing right now with social unrest or whatever you want to call. I mean, it's not just the United States. That's where it's flaring up right now. But we've seen it all over the world over the last few years. And then the Dalio debt cycle. If you look at his video on how he describes that, I think it's economics. Well, what's the video? It's on YouTube. It's I can't recall the video, but it's kind of animated, and it's a real neat video. But he talks about these long term and short term debt cycles, and we're definitely coming to the end of one of these debt cycles, which pretty much is exactly what Chris Cole is saying, but he's just saying it in a different way, and that means that the future for the U.S. economy is most likely not as bright as it was when these debt cycles were on their way up, just for obvious reasons. You know, if you go back to Dalio's thing, I think the point he made was great, that you've got productivity is kind of just this line, and it's very linear, where the debt cycle that goes up, it allows people to consume more than they produce. And therefore, when it comes back down, they have to consume less than they produce. And if you if you land the plane, if you hit the runway, if you have a soft landing, let's say, yes, you can kind of feather it, but do we have a hard landing or a soft landing? I think right now you'd have to bet that we're going to have a hard landing. But moving forward 10 years, 20 years, it means that through the next cycle, Americans and I think most developed economies, they're going to go from being able to consume more than they produce. They're going to have to get accustomed to consuming less or maybe the same if they're lucky. And I think that's going to be a big readjustment for a lot of people in the developed world. Okay, next question. Revival 305. Thank you for the super chat. How would RB Pro, Rebel Capital's Pro, differ from Chris's Insider? Well, it's first of all, it's not the research isn't from Insider. It's from Insider Weekly. So it's from, it's not his, $2,000 product. So I want to keep the price point a lot lower than that. But he has an Insider Weekly, which is kind of a summary of Insider. And so the big difference, and with Lynn's product as well, she has a premium product. Now, with Lynn's premium product, we are going to be using that in Rebel Capitalist Pro. So the way it differs is, number one, you've got a forum, you've got a community, you've got the research, but then you have Lynn, myself, and Chris going on live streams with the members of Rebel Capitalist Pro talking about the specific details of their most recent research and doing live Q&As. And honestly, guys, the reason I built the product the way I did is because that's how I prefer to learn. It's one thing for me to go through, let's say, 10 pages of Insider Weekly from Chris and say, oh, that's interesting, that's interesting. And then you kind of see what he's saying, what he's thinking about. Or Lynn, this is going to be her premium research. So it gets really extensive. I'm talking like 40 pages, sometimes twice a month. So you're getting this research. Yeah, you go through the 40 pages, but Lynn, as you guys know, is incredibly smart. And it was obviously so is Chris. And but you may go through this 40 pages of research and be like, yeah, I get it, but I kind of don't get that one part. And that's the way I think. So I'm like, man, and just honestly, this has been my thought process when I read one of their papers. I'm like, I'd love to ask them a question, but I don't really want to bother them. I mean, I don't want to DM them on Twitter right now because I'm sure they're busy. And I don't know. I don't really want to email Chris or Lynn because maybe it's just a question that I'll figure out. I hate to bother them, right? And honestly, that's my real thought process. So I thought what I want to do with Rebel Capitalist Pro is have their research there available, but also set up an opportunity for when you're going through the research, you write down your own questions and then you can go on a live stream where not only Lynn or Chris talks about each chart they used and why they wrote this and what their thought process was. So you can get a much clearer picture and you don't have to kind of guess what they're thinking. They can sit there and tell you exactly what they're thinking, but then you can go ahead and ask your specific questions. Lynn, what did you mean by this? Chris, what did you mean by this? Why did you use this chart? Why are you saying that I should go into uranium, but I shouldn't go into thorium? And I'm not saying I'm just using that as an example. And then you have me on the live stream as well. And I'm there with Chris or with Lynn, and I'm kind of narrating or I'm kind of just making sure that Chris and Lynn are articulating their thoughts in a way that I can understand. And I know if I can get it, then the members will be able to get it as well. And I just, honestly, this is the product that I want for my own research. So I just created it for Rebel Capitalist Pro. that's honestly how we created the product. But there's going to be a lot more information in the future. And if you want more specifics, email Gene at georgegammon.com. Okay, next question. Matt, thank you for the super chat. Love the shows. Thoughts on properties in Hawaii. My job is moving there in December for 2 years. Thinking about buying first home there. If we don't lose out roughly, if we don't, we lose out on $80,000 of equity. Oh, is that because you need to do a 1031 exchange? That's my guess, Matt. So Oahu, Hawaii, my job. Okay, so you got to go there. That's bottom line. Think of buying our first home there. Well, no, you're buying your first home. So I'm not sure where you're losing out on the 80 grand of equity. Maybe you're thinking by renting that the rent, you're kind of flushing it down the toilet. But you really need to do the numbers on the rent compared to buying and make sure you're factoring in all the costs of buying, such as property taxes and interest that you're paying. Now, that said, maybe prices are going down there. You might be able to get a decent break on the price. I think probably what I would do, Matt, is job is moving there in December. Oh, you've got some time. Okay, you've got some time. So what I would be doing if I was in your position right now is I would be on Zillow like every day, assuming that a Zillow works in Hawaii. I know it works in PR, so it's got to work in Hawaii. And I just start getting like downloading, absorbing as much information, as much data as I possibly could. What are the price per square foot? What are the property taxes? Like, you know, what rate? I'd look at the loan options there. I'm assuming they've got a Fannie product that would give you a 30-year fixed rate. Maybe they don't. Maybe they do. I don't know. I'd start doing the homework right now. I would just start processing. I'd start trying to figure out what the comps were, what the good neighborhoods were. I would be looking at, when you go on Zillow and you click on the property, you can go under the price history and see if they've dropped the price. I'd see how many, if that's an overall theme in the market. I'd look at the RV ratios. And I would start, like, as an example, if the RV ratio is like 0.2, let's just say it's horrific, 0.2, then I'd know it'd probably actually cheaper to rent, all things considered. And that's going to be a better financial decision. And I might want to keep that powder dry that I would have used for a down payment to you know, maybe go into some cheap dividend paying stocks or wait for them to get cheap. Or maybe take the equity when, if real estate gets a lot cheaper in the United States, go into a more linear market and use the equity to buy a rental property. And again, I'm not talking about right now. I'm talking about maybe 2 years when things hopefully settle down here a little bit and maybe prices come to you. And maybe 80,000 is maybe your down payment, but that you might be able to make a lot more on that equity by renting in Hawaii and putting the equity to work somewhere else in the United States. You know, that's what Hartman always suggests doing. And that's what I used to do too. When I was in the States, I would just rent wherever I lived, I would rent. And then I owned a ton of real estate, but I never owned where I lived. I always rented where I lived and owned other places because the RV ratio on where I lived would have been lower than one. It would have been like 0.5, if not worse in some of the places. So that's hopefully that answered your question. I know I didn't answer it directly, but I hopefully I've given you enough food for thought that you can start doing some homework and coming to your own conclusions. Daniel, thank you for the super chat. Hey, George, would you consider doing a whiteboard video critiquing Milton Friedman's idea on monetary policy, maybe compared to Rothbard? Yeah, I think that's a really cool idea. I think Friedman's biggest thing was velocity. I don't think he thought velocity was consistent, and we know it's not consistent. And of course, I don't know what you're referring to specifically, but Rothbard is going to be, I wouldn't call Friedman an interventionist by any stretch of the imagination, but I think Rothbard would be even less of whatever Friedman is as far as his ideas on what the Fed should or should not do. You know, going back to the Depression, Friedman he thought the central bank should have done more And I can't imagine Rothbard having that stance. But yeah, I think I'd like to juxtapose those two and also viewing them through the lens of the Depression in the 1930s. And then what would be a fun thought experiment is what both of them would suggest for today, what the Fed does today. I mean, I think you can guess what they would say, but I think it would be a fun thought experiment to really go through that. So yeah, for sure, for sure. I'm not sure when I can get to the video, but I'll definitely consider it. Yeah, it's a neat idea. Thank you very much, Daniel. Patriot, George, thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for the super chat. George, thanks for sharing your wisdom and knowledge. I cannot come up with a scenario where coal will recover. What am I missing? Order out for the stiff drink and good food on me. Well, you're just missing the price, first and foremost. Is it cheap now or not? You don't have to have a real strong bullish argument for coal saying, oh, it's going to go up for this reason. There's going to be more demand. There's going to be, the fundamentals are fantastic. Boy, you got to get in now, right? That's really not what we're doing. We're just saying, you know, relative, even if demand goes down by 50%, let's say, is it still cheap right now? And if the question is yes, then it's cheap. Let's use a Tesla as an example. And I know I'm always hard on Tesla, but I don't know what Tesla's at, maybe 800, let's call it. So do I like Tesla at 800? No way. Do I like Tesla at $5? Maybe. I think it could be interesting at $5. And that doesn't mean that I'm wildly bullish on the future of the company or bearish. Doesn't mean either of those. I just know that based on what it has right now, that's really cheap. So it's the same thing for oil, right? I mean, there's a lot of headwind for oil in the future and long term with renewables and green energy and most likely the political narrative and the social narrative. But that doesn't mean that at negative $40 a barrel that it's cheap. And you should buy it at negative $40 a barrel. So it's kind of, I don't look at coal that way. And so to take it further, I don't think that as far as coal recovering, a lot of the coal companies are dealing with buyers outside the United States. So I don't know that demand in the United States has to quote unquote recover for the price to go up significantly, nor do I think it has to recover for them to continue to pay their dividend. And remember, I'm mostly with coal, I'm just buying cheap cash. And I know they can cancel their dividend, but if you can buy something so cheap that the downside's very low, I think you got to do it. And if they can cover their dividend last year, I think they'll be able to cover their dividend again. And if they don't, I definitely could be wrong. And that's why you want to have some diversity within your portfolio for sure. You don't want all your eggs in that basket. But that's how I look at coal. I don't really have to be wildly bullish on coal to like the current price. I think that's what I'm trying to say. Okay, next question. Revival 305. Thank you for the super chat. What does long volatility mean? Well, it means that your investments are going up when what's happening to the United States right now is happening. technically it doesn't mean that. What that means is volatility in markets. Let's take the S&P, is when prices are fluctuating dramatically day to day. So over the last 10 years, call it, we've had crazy lack of volatility where just pretty much, the swings in the S&P or rarely even 1% per day. That's very rare. Where what we had in March, as an example, was extremely volatile. You were seeing 3, 4, 5, 6, 7% price moves in the S&P daily. That's crazy. That is a lot of volatility. So if you had an investment or a speculation that did well under when there was volatility in the market, that would be considered long volatility. I think what I'm talking about, and I think maybe what Hugh and Raul were talking about the other day, is just from a personal standpoint, their long volatility with where they have chosen to buy real estate and where they have chosen to spend time. So I use the example of me being in Columbia right now. Where I am, based on the Cerveza sickness, and it's long volatility compared to the U.S., but it's not long volatility compared to St. Bart's. That is for sure. I am locked up in an apartment. And true, we don't have violence. Thank goodness we don't have all the riots. But I'm in a very nice apartment. I can't complain. There's Carrara marble over there and a lot of wood and fancy stuff. But I'm still locked in an apartment. So that's not long volatility compared to other options. So I think you have, the way I'm looking at volatility right now, and I'm saying that on Twitter and saying that in the live stream, is I'm saying not only being long volatility in your portfolio or with your portfolio, but also being long volatility with your physical location. So long volatility with your social, with your physical location is being out of the way of this social unrest. And with your portfolio, it's more so if the stock market's going way up or way down or way up or way down all the time, then what in your portfolio is going to benefit from that? Adam, thank you for the super chat. Huge fan. I appreciate it, Adam. I've taken your advice on a couple single family rentals in linear markets. Okay. I'd like to take more of your advice and visit Medellin. Is there a safe coastal city I could travel to? Oh, listen, Colombia is very safe. It's forget all the. Trust me. There are very few things I say with 100% confidence. As you guys know, it's all about probabilities. It's not about certainties. But that is one thing I can say with almost 100% confidence, is that if any of you come to Colombia or Medellin, you're going to, within 20 minutes of being here, you're going to be in your head, you're going to be saying, what on earth was I worried about? This is the safest place. This feels like the safest place I've ever been. What on earth was I worried about? I just wasted so much time and energy worrying about nothing. But as far as any of the cities you go, I mean, look at Cartagena, for heaven's sakes. They got big tour boats coming in. I mean, it's one of the safest places I think you could ever be. Cartagena or Santa Marta. I've never been to Barranquilla, but I can't suggest Cartagena enough. Especially if you like salsa dancing and you like the Miami vibe and you like South Beach, Miami. Ugh, you love Cartagena. Love it. And they just built a new mall there that's probably the most impressive mall I have ever seen in my life. It was actually built into an old coliseum where they used to do bullfighting, and they turned it into a mall. It's incredible. It's so, so cool. Definitely the coolest mall I've ever seen. Right now, you don't want to come down because of what's going on with the Cerveza sickness. And I would actually hold off, even if they open up, because if we have a second wave, you don't want to get stuck here like I am. But in the future, when this thing is in the rearview mirror, definitely a place to spend some time and consider if you're thinking of spending time outside the U.S. Let me make sure I answered your question here. Yeah. So when this is in the rearview mirror, definitely visit Medellin. I think you'll love it. And as far as the coastal city, don't worry about safety. That should be the last of your concerns coming to Colombia. As far as the coastal cities, and I think you'd love Cartagena, and I think you would really, really love Santa Marta. And if you go to Santa Marta, make sure you stay in the old town part. That's my favorite. And if you go to Cartagena, make sure you check out Old Town. Everyone does. And then make sure you check out that mall. I think you'll love it. It's really cool. Okay, next question. T-Con, thank you for the super chat. What's up, G? Question from Sacramento, California. 290 grand prime residential. Okay. Value, I'm assuming that's your equity. Value at 660, could rent for 3,000 a month. Let's see, 0.5 RV. 75 gold, 10K silver, 100K cash, and $150,000 a year job. Well, you're in a pretty good position there, T-Con. Yeah, congratulations. I think you're doing well. Curious what you would advise, suggest, change. First thing I would do is I would move to Reno. And assuming that your job had flexibility. So let me just say that. And then I'll give you advice on if you have to stay in California. I would get to Reno as fast as I could. I think Reno, last time I was there was maybe a year and a half ago. And I know a lot of people, as you probably know, are moving there from the Bay Area. A lot of little tech companies are going there. They've got kind of a neat little trendy area that's popping up. I wouldn't hesitate to buy real estate there if I could get a 1% RV ratio. And from a tax standpoint, I think you're going to really, especially someone in your position that makes good money and has a good size portfolio and a decent net worth, you're going to have an increasingly bigger target on your back in California and other states as well, but especially California. Boy, they're going to be coming after you. So that's what I do first and foremost. Now, let me go back to, I'm guessing the 20K is in equity in the house valued at 660. I hope I'm not wrong there, but I'm going to assume that's your question. So you've got, let me do the math here. You've got 290, so let's call it 300, 400. Let's call it roughly 500. You got 75 in gold. I hate to say you got too much in gold, but for me, I'd have a little less in gold. But I don't know, man. With what's going on right now in the world, maybe over 10% is okay. So I don't think I'd be too worried about that. 100K cash, I think that's great. 10K silver, great, because you want maybe 50 in speculation. And so what I might do is I might go take 25 of your gold and sell it and do another 25 in silver. So you got 50 in gold and 35 in silver. So then you're closer to the 10%. In insurance and 10% in speculation, but you're still keeping it within the precious metals. That's something I'd consider. I like your cash. I'd probably keep it in short-term T-bills. Just roll it over. And then if you've got 290 in equity, I would hit the bid. I hate to suggest doing something that's kind of a big step. But if it were me, I would sell the house. I would either rent if you can't move to Reno, if you got to stay there for your job, and I would take the equity and I would try to allocate it in an area that had better RV ratios. And maybe not now. Maybe I'd sit on it for a while, let the market come to me. But when it does come to me, I'd take the 290 or 300 and buy a couple rental properties in a linear market where I was getting a 1% RV ratio. And then I'd just take the money that I was collecting in rent from the positive cash flow, and I would use that to pay my rent. And you'd most likely still have a lot left over. And you're in a much less cyclical market. You're in a market that's probably a lot more landlord friendly, where you're not, where you most likely won't have to deal with rent control anytime soon. And that's what I would do. But congratulations, first and foremost, buddy. You're doing great, making good money. You got a nice portfolio working there. Congratulations. Okay, next question. Miguel, thank you for the super chat. I either give you my $2, you, or the liar bought off Fed. Okay. I don't fully understand the question, Miguel, but I appreciate the super chat nonetheless. Thank you very much. It looks like you're not a big fan of the Fed, and I think we can all agree on that. Okay, cool, guys. Well, thank you very much for joining me on the live stream today. I know there's a lot going on in the United States. I mean, my prayers are with all of you for sure. I have family in the U.S., and I'm very concerned about them right now. It's probably what I'm going to do later on this afternoon is give my mom a call and my sister and my brother and see how they're doing there. But I really want to emphasize the fact that we can either sit back and worry and complain, or we can understand what's going on in the world around us, and we can be proactive and do what we need to do to make sure we're taking care of ourselves and our families, and that we're trying to find opportunity. We're trying to find, we're trying to look at the glass half full. I know it's very difficult to do, but we're trying to find how we can improve the future for ourselves, how we can build wealth, how we can thrive in this world of out of control central banks and big governments, and now a lot of social unrest. So I appreciate you guys being on the live stream. And I'll see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.